The Battle for Liberty, Episode 50.
This is the Battle for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Battle for Liberty. Once again, I'm your host, Mike Tilden. Thanks so much for joining me on the podcast dedicated to the journey of the libertarian novice. Don't ever miss an episode of the Battle for Liberty. Make sure you're subscribed on iTunes and Stitcher. That way, every episode will be delivered to your device with no effort required. It couldn't be easier. Alright, getting a little bit of a late start to the episode this week. I apologize, I'm not recording this episode until after the typical release time for my weekly episodes, but have no fear, you're getting this episode just a few days late. So, back in July of this year, I missed a pretty good opportunity to celebrate a major milestone as an independently produced podcast. On July 7th of 2016, The Battle for Liberty released its very first episode titled My Battle for Liberty. To this day, I still recommend that you listen to it. You can find that at battleforliberty.com/1. I think you should go listen to that. It's really interesting to hear the very first episode after we've done 49 episodes and after today, 50. But being that it was 1 year ago on July 7th, 2017, I should have drawn attention to the show's one-year anniversary on the release date of that particular episode, but I didn't. And so since I missed that opportunity to celebrate the one-year milestone, I thought it might be nice to celebrate 50 as a milestone. So episode 50 is where we're going to be celebrating our nice milestone. It's been a little bit more than a year, but 50 episodes, not too shabby for an independent podcast. So first, what I want to do is kind of share with you what I think I have to be thankful for as it relates to this podcast. And it's amazing to think about how far this show has come. Since the debut a little more than a year ago, the show has grown on average about 40% per month. Now, no doubt I've had my ups and downs with listenership, but overall, the growth curve is headed in the right direction. And just to be clear, the growing download number trend line is important to me only because it signals that there's an audience that wants to learn more about the principles of liberty, things like non-aggression, property rights, economics, individualism, self-government, free market, you know, all the stuff we talk about. The fact that the show is growing tells me that people are indeed interested in those topics, and that is what I'm really happy for, above and beyond the raw growing numbers. And along the way, I'm actually really proud to say that I've had a couple of people tell me that this podcast has been instrumental in changing the way that they think about political organization. That's a tremendous win for the cause of liberty. So, during the last year, I've brought you now 50 unique episodes, chocked full of information for the budding libertarian, including 50 unique show notes pages, jam-packed with references, links, sources, and recommendations for further study. Overall, I've introduced you to 12 interesting and informative guests, and I've learned that there are people listening to the Battle for Liberty all over the world. 44 countries, to be exact. Finally, I started a Patreon campaign for listeners who want to help support the show financially, and I'm pleased to say I have a group of core patrons who are helping me continue to bring the show to you free of charge. And in return, these patrons enjoy exclusive benefits that only they receive, things like patron-only blog posts, behind-the-scenes photos, short video clips that I produce, and bonus podcast episodes. So, you know, I'm always in need of more help. I haven't gotten to a place yet where the show is fully self-sustaining. So if you'd like to join the ranks of the elite patrons, you can do so for as little as $1 per month over at battleforliberty.com/support. Suffice to say, the show is growing, and together we are spreading the word about the battle for liberty, and I am so incredibly grateful to you, the listener, for your support and attention. Episode number 50 is a big one for me, so I hope you're celebrating as I am. All right, so what exactly do I have in mind for the 50th episode? Well, since the show has grown so much in the last several months alone, I thought it might be a good time to revisit the mission of the show and to restate the primary libertarian principles. And then, if we have enough time, maybe share with you my favorite episodes from the first 50. So that's what we're going to do today. So let's start off with the mission of the show. I feel that at episode number 50, it's a good time to restate things, to make sure that everyone who's listening, if you haven't gone back and listened to the first couple of episodes where I explained what the mission of the show was, that's okay. I still think you should listen to all the episodes, but let's go ahead and go back through it again here. So as you hear in every introduction to this show, the show is dedicated to the journey of the libertarian novice. But why? Why do I focus on the newcomer to the libertarian world? Well, simply put, I want to make sure that there's a resource available to people who find themselves in the situation I found myself in 5 years ago. See, 5 years ago, I was doing some intellectual soul searching, so to speak. As you heard about in episode number one, of all the things in the world, what sparked my journey towards libertarianism was the defeat of Mitt Romney in the 2012 presidential election. I know, it's not the most glamorous tale of political conversion, but I feel it's probably a relatable one. See, I had previously been convinced that the only thing necessary to usher in a new era of freedom and limited government was for the Republicans to retake the presidency. Oh yeah, I thought that was going to do it for sure. I had swallowed the Republican rhetoric of small government hook, line, and sinker. Well, when Mitt Romney lost, my immediate reaction was disappointment and really disbelief. I mean, in my mind, Barack Obama represented the quickest, surest path to socialism in the United States. And when I learned that the majority of voters either didn't see that or didn't find that to be a bad thing, I finally lost all remaining hope in the entire notion of popularly elected government or democratic government. And once that happened, once I let go of the idolatry of democratic politics, I was forced to ask myself difficult questions, really for the first time as an adult, to really examine my political philosophy. So the first question that I asked myself, which is very basic, was, well, if Mitt Romney had won, would it have been better? Perhaps from a social standpoint, maybe the argument can be made that it may have been slightly better for someone with conservative leanings to have taken the White House. But from a political level, I had to ask myself, you know, if Romney had won in 2012, would it have made it okay to continue violating the Constitution via the DEA and the FDA and the TSA and Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid? You know, none of those programs find justification in the Constitution, and yet no Republican, especially not Mitt Romney, had ever voted to repeal those or had stood opposed to them. If Romney had won, would the government have suddenly begun spending less? Would the size of the federal government have been reduced even a little? Or would it simply have grown at just a slightly slower rate than it would have under Barack Obama? And when I really thought about the history of the Republican Party and their history of out-of-control spending, crony capitalism, unsound monetary policy, unconstitutional wars, both foreign and domestic, and big government-style actions, despite their small government rhetoric, I had to come to an unmistakable conclusion, and that was my political philosophy was a shamble of inconsistency and ignorance. I had been duped by what Tom Woods refers to as the 3x5 card of allowable opinion. And so it was Mitt Romney's loss that led me to start researching and reading about the alternatives to the Republican versus Democrat nonsense. And this is precisely when I found libertarianism, or the political philosophy of libertarianism, not the political party. That's an important distinction. And so the purpose of this podcast is to serve as a resource for anyone who finds themselves with a political philosophy that's inconsistent and possibly ignorant of history and basic economics. And as you listen to the show week after week, my goal is to introduce you to the solution that you've been seeking, consistency of political philosophy, which can only be found within the libertarian political philosophy. All right, now that's a rather bold claim. How do I arrive at the claim that libertarianism as a philosophy is the only consistent political philosophy? To answer that question, we need to review what I refer to as the two primary principles of libertarianism, which are non-aggression and property rights. I make that very clear from the very beginning of this podcast that I have identified the primary principles of libertarianism to be non-aggression and property rights. And certainly we could quabble over whether or not non-aggression is really just a part of property rights or property rights are really just a part of non-aggression. And unfortunately, many libertarians do quabble over that. I have no interest. I don't care. It could be one or the other. It doesn't matter to me. The two primary topics and themes that you will hear about time in and time out is non-aggression and property rights. So let's start with non-aggression. Perhaps the most basic principle behind the libertarian philosophy is called the non-aggression principle. And simply stated, the non-aggression principle claims that aggression against the person or property of others is always wrong. And aggression is defined narrowly as the use or threat of physical violence. Now, we make it quite clear that non-aggression does not mean pacifism. If someone attacks you, you absolutely can defend yourself because in the case of self-defense, you are not an aggressor, you are a defender. This is why we hold to the non-aggression principle and not simply the non-violence principle. That's a really important distinction, and oftentimes the non-aggression principle puts people off from libertarianism because they think that it means that they always have to be peaceful no matter what. You have to understand the difference between aggression and violence. Sometimes violence is necessary as long as you are not the aggressor. Then it's totally within the bounds of the non-aggression principle. Okay? Now, we should keep in mind, and it shouldn't go over our heads, that this is precisely the principle that you're taught as a child by your parents, your teachers, your religious leaders, your elder family members. Didn't they always tell you, we don't hit people, while at the same time telling you that if someone on the playground picks a fight with you, well, it's okay to use reasonable and limited force to defend yourself. Isn't that what everyone always taught? And on the individual level, this is not controversial at all to really anyone. In fact, it seems universal. Who could possibly disagree with this so far? But the trouble comes in when we start thinking about more than just the individual. What about when we start thinking about groups of people or communities or cities or counties or states? Then we start to see that people can be easily convinced that the non-aggression principle shouldn't be applied consistently. We see this line of reasoning from people that we often refer to on this show as statists. Now, quickly, let's define statist, because I use the word a lot. So a statist is simply someone who believes that groups of people have rights and authorities that individuals do not possess. A statist believes that immoral acts can be made moral simply because of numerical majorities. And the Republican and Democrat parties in the United States both subscribe to this line of thinking. And to be fair, the Libertarian Party also sometimes subscribes to a bit of this nonsense as well. So if you have to understand right from the very beginning that the vast majority of political philosophy, at least in the United States, and that's where I limit my discussion, is to the United States because that's really my only experience. But anyways, the vast majority of political philosophy in the U.S. is based on logical inconsistency. And once you understand that, then public policy and government lunacy actually starts to make a little bit more sense. It starts to come into focus why things are contradictory. Well, because the very base of your political philosophy is contradictory, right? It's wrong to hit people or to initiate violence. except if you're a group of people, then it's okay. See, that immediate disconnect right from the very beginning explains how public policy, political policy, winds up being so convoluted and inconsistent. So let's take a deeper look at that inconsistency that I'm talking about as it applies to the non-aggression principle. The first example I want to go through is theft. Now, it's fairly obvious to most people that it's wrong for me to steal from you. I can't walk up to your house, knock on your door, and when you answer the door, shove a gun in your face and rob you. Even if I tell you that the money I'm taking is going to be used for a charity that feeds homeless people, I still don't have the right to do it, do I? I think almost everyone agrees and sees how that's wrong, how that's immoral. But if a group of people get together in a strong majority and pass a law that says you have to donate your money to a charity, and if that law also says that if you refuse, men with guns will come and they'll try to take it forcefully, and if you still refuse and resist, that they'll throw you in a cage as punishment. And if you resist being thrown into that cage, eventually, that group, the men with guns hired by the numerical majority, they will eventually come and use deadly force to try to make an example of you or to force your cooperation. If a group of people get together and pass that rule, well, this is perfectly okay. And we call it taxation. And somewhere in there, statists argue, the immoral act of theft was sanctified and made moral because enough people got together and agreed that it's okay. This is a clear inconsistency, and only the libertarian political philosophy calls it out for what it is and opposes it. Republicans don't oppose taxation, Democrats don't oppose taxation, only libertarians remain consistent on this. If theft is wrong for one person, it is also wrong for a numerical majority. All right, the next example in inconsistency, as it applies to the non-aggression principle, is slavery. Everyone listening to this podcast would agree that if I rounded up a group of people and shoved a gun in their face and told them that they had to work for me for a period of 2 hours or 2 days or 2 weeks or 2 months or 2 years, regardless of the length of involuntary servitude, that this would be considered slavery and it would be totally immoral, reprehensible, and unacceptable, not to be tolerated in a civilized society. I do not have the right to enslave anybody. But if a group of people gets together and decides that, well, this thing that we call a nation just doesn't have enough members in its military, and so they conscript you into their ranks, and they force you to follow all orders, travel to faraway lands, and to possibly murder people you've never met and have no problem with, well, this is okay. This is thought of as perfectly acceptable, and we call this the draft, or conscription. It's still legal, even if it isn't currently utilized. The draft and conscription in the United States is still the law of the land. Every 18-year-old male has to register with Selective Service. It is the law. You must do it. Again, this is another clear inconsistency. And again, only the libertarian political philosophy calls it out for what it is and opposes it. All right, the final example of inconsistency as it relates to the non-aggression principle is murder. I hesitate, but only briefly, to say that it's universally agreed upon in the civilized world that murdering people is wrong. I'm not sure I could find a single solitary person who would argue in favor of murder. But again, almost magically, if a group of people get together and decide that another group of people are a danger to them, then the mass murder of innocent third parties, which is callously referred to as collateral damage, is totally acceptable. Well, we're at war, so sorry, you were in the wrong place at the wrong time. We can murder hundreds, thousands of innocent people, and there's no problem. It happened during war, so it's not immoral at all. All of a sudden, the deaths of countless innocent people, based purely on their unlucky geographic position on this planet, completely excused and justified. We should never forget that when Secretary of State Madeleine Albright was questioned in 1995 about the death of 500,000 children as a result of U.S. foreign policy, her response was, well, we believe the price was worth it. 500,000 children died, And she didn't question the statistics. She didn't say, well, I doubt the numbers. I don't think that's right. What's your source? She accepted the statistic, looked right at the interviewer and said, 500,000? Yeah, that's worth it. This is another clear inconsistency. And again, only the libertarian political philosophy calls war what it is and consistently opposes it. So all of this goes to make the case that the vast majority of people in the United States today hold on to some sort of political philosophy that is wholly inconsistent when it comes to the idea that it's wrong to aggress against others. When applied to individuals, yes, most people agree that non-aggression is the way to go. But as soon as we start applying our judgments to groups of people, well, suddenly something amazing and almost magical happens. Somehow, now that we're talking about groups of people, immoral, unacceptable actions are sanctified and purified by the numerical majorities, and they become moral and acceptable. When it's put this way, it should be easy to see how preposterous these inconsistencies are. Let's pause for one moment for this message. Hey there, Battle for Liberty listener. Are you looking to start up a website, maybe a podcast or a blog, or even a website for your business? Well, if so, I've got the deal of a century for you. If you want to start a website, you have to have web hosting. And I think you should get your web hosting through Bluehost. It's the web hosting I use for the podcast here at the Battle for Liberty. Bluehost has some of the best prices you will ever see for web hosting. Just $3.95 a month. But you have to use my special link in order to get that special price. So go over to battleforliberty.com/blue to sign up for your web hosting today. It's easy, it's fast, they're very responsive, and you're going to get a great price. That's battleforliberty.com/blue. All right, so now I want to move on to the second primary principle of libertarianism, and that is property rights. I'll summarize this point today, but if you want a deeper look at property rights, I highly recommend episode 14 of this podcast, in which I dedicated an entire 40-minute episode entirely to the idea of property rights. And that's available at battleforliberty.com/14. So the libertarian notion of property rights stems from the theory of natural law. The idea behind property rights starts with a question. And that question is, who owns you? There are conceivably three possible answers to the question of who owns you. The first one is you own yourself. The second option is somebody else owns you. And the third option is each and every single person on the planet owns a tiny, fractional, equal portion of each and every other person. Like I said, those are the only three conceivable options that we know of. And when examined carefully, the only logical answer is that you indeed own yourself. We find it easy to dismiss the notion that someone else owns you. By the very nature of all of us on the planet being human beings, it would be impossible for one group to hold some sort of right over other human beings, because if you want to make the argument that humans can own humans because this group of humans is not human, it immediately contradicts itself. We're talking about humans, so there can't be a property ownership where one human can own another human. So then we have to ask, is it possible that we all own tiny fractional portions of everybody else? This, of course, would be a form of communism. Well, the answer, again, must be no. It's an absurdity to think of it that way. If that were true, you would need to take a vote of, 6 billion people anytime you wanted to make a personal decision, like cutting your hair or undergoing surgery or maybe getting a tattoo. You'd need to get the permission of 6 billion other people. And even if we attempted that kind of arrangement, we know from history what would happen is that a very small group of people would claim authority over the decisions of the people in their territory and begin using a nasty form of forced power of attorney to subjugate and tyrannize. So by process of elimination, we must then conclude that each person fully and wholly owns himself and nobody else. So from here, then, we must realize that each and every person must logically own the fruit of their labor. For example, If no one has claimed the right to a certain tree that I find in the woods, nobody owns it, nobody's claimed it, there's no, it hasn't been approved upon, it's just sitting there out in the middle of the woods. And if I use my labor, which I own, and my person, which I own, to cut down the tree and make it into a wooden beam suitable for building a house, and I eventually do build a house out of wood that I created from raw trees that that I alone justly became the owner of, then I should be said to be the owner of that house as well. This is the natural rights theory of property rights. And if I am said to be the property owner, then who else would be justified in determining what is done with that property? Who else can say what I use it for, to whom I sell it, and for what price, to whom I charitably donate? Natural rights demands that only I, the property owner, can make this type of determination. And of course, it also allows for the disposal of that property. If I decide to sell my property, then it becomes wholly and fully the property of someone else. As long as that transaction was completely voluntary, you can absolutely transfer property. And this is indeed how property comes into ownership. You either homestead it, which is the process that I just laid out. You find something unclaimed, you improve upon it, you make it worthwhile for human use or consumption. You've homesteaded that property, it's yours. Or if you have acquired property justly and you want to dispose of it, enter into a voluntary contract with someone and you dispose of that property, well then the other person is now the just owner of that property. Now, on the surface, many statists, when contemplating the property rights of the individual, they might agree that only you can own yourself. They may even agree that only you can own the fruits of your labor. But again, the political philosophy of the statist fails to maintain consistency when we start to talk about groups of people. As soon as we begin thinking about a group of people in a given geographic territory, a statist will quickly and easily claim that you no longer possess all of the rights over your justly acquired property. Suddenly, the dirty, unjustified act of claiming ownership over someone else's property or person becomes clean and perfectly justified. Again, this is blatantly inconsistent and unjust, but the statist does not care. And all the libertarian political philosophy does is demand that these basic moral principles, non-aggression and natural property rights, are adhered to consistently. And so finally, we must ask a further question that might have been on your mind this entire time while you've listened to this exposition. And that is, well, why is consistency so important? I mean, really, why am I obsessed with consistency? Is there something intrinsically good about consistency and something intrinsically bad about inconsistency? Now, that is a very important question because so far, it seems like my entire argument for the supremacy of the libertarian political philosophy hinges upon its consistency. But if consistency is worthless, then who cares, right? I mean, might as well be a neocon Republican or a tree-hugging progressive, right? So to answer that question about the importance of consistency, we need to go back a little bit deeper and a little bit more philosophical and even a little bit more basic and remember that we live in a world full of scarcity. There simply aren't enough of every single good or resource to satisfy all of the wants and needs of the people who live on this planet. That is a universally acknowledged truth that nobody refutes. Everybody accepts that we live in a world of scarcity. So because we live in a world of scarcity, it naturally follows that there is a potential for conflict around every corner. There's too many people who want too little resources. That is an immediate source of conflict. And so what mankind has been trying to do for millennia is arrive at a system of resource allocation that yields what Tom Woods describes as a peaceful, objective, conflict-avoiding system of property ownership that would assign these scarce resources to an owner who can exercise a range of control over them. That is ultimately the goal of political organization, right? So let's unpack that system that Professor Woods has described because it's a little in-depth. So the first characteristic that he talked about referred to the fact that the system must be peaceful. Well, that one makes sense, right? I mean, the whole point is to avoid conflict in this system. So it would necessarily have to be peaceful, right? I think that one's a gimme. But next, the system has to be objective, meaning that everyone is capable of recognizing the link between a person and a person's property. There needs to be some sort of universal link that makes sense to everyone. Now, if the link between a person and the property that that person claims was merely subjective, well, this wouldn't serve to avoid conflict at all. All anyone would need to do is just declare that, well, I feel like I own this, and then they could pursue enforcement of that ownership. Well, that wouldn't work very well at all, because everyone would just claim that they feel like they own a Maserati or lakefront property. So the system must be objective. Everyone has to be able to look at the link between a person and their property and say, yeah, that makes sense. So let's back up and recall again why we're knee-deep in rights theory in the first place. We're trying to answer the question of why consistency of political philosophy is so important. And now we understand that the goal of political organization is to arrive at a peaceful, objective, conflict-avoiding system of property ownership that assigns these scarce resources to just owners who can exercise control over them. So now we've finally arrived at our answer, whether you know it or not. The reason consistency is so important in a political philosophy is because without consistency, you simply can't achieve a system that meets the goals of society, namely conflict avoiding. Now, when I talk about a system that avoids conflict, I don't mean to suggest that we seek to avoid all conflict in outcomes. A system where you avoid all conflict in outcomes is a utopia, and that is an impossibility. The important distinction is that the system of political organization that we're seeking is one that avoids conflict in the system itself, not necessarily in the outcome of the system. After all, one of the given inputs in this entire thought exercise is that scarcity exists. Therefore, we have to understand right from the very beginning that the outcomes will not be equal, and therefore, there will always be conflict in terms of the equality of property ownership. That's unavoidable. But what we've been in search of here is a system that itself seeks to avoid conflict in the determination of who is designated as a proper owner of property. And as we've demonstrated, that objective necessarily demands consistency. And so we've finally arrived at our conclusion, which is, because we live in a world of scarce resources, and because we seek a system of political organization that seeks to be peaceful, objective, and conflict avoiding during the assignment of ownership of scarce resources, we must therefore conclude that the only viable system of political organization is one that maintains consistency in its basic rules. And I previously showed you that only one system we know of today maintains consistency, and that's the libertarian system, and it honors non-aggression and natural property rights. Any other system of organization that exists today is inherently inconsistent at the system's level, and therefore it yields us not peace, not objectivity, and does not avoid conflict. And if the system itself fails to achieve those objectives, then naturally the outcomes of those other systems will lead to far greater injustice in the assignment of ownership of the scarce resources available on this planet. Therefore, libertarians are opposed to the things that other political philosophies seem to cling to, things like taxation, conscription, aggressive foreign wars. And there are a lot of other things that we're opposed to, too, like the drug war, the welfare state, regulation of property, the violation of the freedom of association. I could go on and on and on. But as I've stated many times on the show, sometimes a consistent political philosophy leads you to uncomfortable conclusions. For example, an uncomfortable conclusion that voluntary prostitution, while morally reprehensible to me, should not be controlled or regulated by the state. Certainly, it should be discouraged by religious and community organizations, and it should be something that we try to avoid, but the state has no business regulating it. See, what I've found through my study of the various political philosophies is that only the libertarian philosophy allows me to sleep at night. Remember, at the very beginning of my journey into libertarianism, one thing that dawned on me was that my political philosophy was in shambles. It was inconsistent, it was not well-researched, it was not backed up by much, I couldn't stand behind it. I found myself bending over backwards into pretzels trying to justify the fact that well, I was pro-life, but at the same time, I supported all of the foreign wars where countless, certainly thousands and thousands of innocent children were being bombed to smithereens. Well, just wrong place, wrong time, right? I couldn't justify that. Well, only the libertarian philosophy allows me to sleep at night. Only a strict adherence to non-aggression and natural property rights conforms to a peaceful, respectful, and just social order. And certainly no libertarian worth his salt would argue that this strict adherence to the primary principles would result in a utopia. As I said earlier in the episode, that's an impossibility, and no adult-thinking libertarian argues that a libertarian political organization would result in a utopia. Libertarians are upfront and realistic in the admission that no matter how society is arranged, there will always be bad actors and unfortunate tragedies. What we as libertarians ask is that we don't try to ham-fistedly counteract the inherent immorality of humanity with even more immorality in our system of organization. Put another way, libertarians realize that regardless of how many people get together and take a vote, two wrongs still don't make a right. Okay, I hope that was a good summary of why this podcast exists, what I intend to do, and what libertarians believe in terms of a political philosophy. If this sounds like something that you're interested in, this is what you're going to hear about every week. I've been doing it for 50 episodes now. My loyal listeners know we always come back to those primary principles. Well, I got a lot of new listeners recently, and I wanted to make sure we were all on the same page. So I took episode 50, a great milestone for an independent podcast, and decided it was time to restate the mission, re-explain why I'm doing this, where I've come from, and where I'm going. So that's going to do it for today. I'm sorry I didn't have time to get to my favorite episodes. I think what I'm going to do is make that a bonus episode for my patrons. So if you're interested in hearing my favorite episodes and my take on how they were received, head on over to battleforliberty.com/support and sign up to be a patron today. As I've said, it takes only $1 a month to become a patron. So check that out at battleforliberty.com/support. As always, check out the show notes page. Today it's going to be battleforliberty.com/50. There you'll find all of the links and references that we've talked about on this episode. You'll also find information about connecting with the show on Twitter and Facebook, and you can submit questions and topics for future shows. Send us a positive review on either iTunes or Stitcher. Let's get some 5-star ratings in the record books. That will really help me grow the show. Finally, don't forget to refer your friends. Keep spreading the word about the battle for liberty. Until next time, battle on!